My name is Winston Cabot again. Those of you who were here yesterday know that. And this is the second of a probably three-part session on the U.S. healthcare system. And today, the topic is designing our healthcare and judging our options. Yesterday, as those of you who were here know, I presented a fairly fulminant critique, I think, of our current healthcare system under the title of Crisis and Contradictions. I talked a lot yesterday, for which I apologize, and today I hope that you'll, and today is going to be, I hope, more discussion, and also I hope that you'll interrupt me with experiences or comments or questions or whatever you have as we go along. Just to kind of summarize for the few of you who weren't here yesterday what we talked about yesterday, I talked about two aspects of the healthcare crisis best summed up. One, I think, is the moral crisis that we have in this country now, 37 million or so and quickly rising individuals who don't really have any healthcare benefits, any healthcare financing access at all, and that there are about twice as many individuals who only have partial insurance, the quote, underinsured. That our system comes down hardest on the poor, on children, on young adults who are just starting out in their adult lives, and on racial minorities. As a consequence, we have people rejected from emergency rooms at the rate of 300,000 a year or so in the last few years. Many people denied hospital admissions and denied services by clinics of their choice. And the public health consequences of that are that we have perhaps the highest infant death rates and the male and female individual, or male and female mortality rates of really just about any developed country in the world, that we have many women who are in childbearing years but don't have any prenatal care benefits and cannot get access to prenatal care, that we have many individuals without adequate or perhaps even minimal access to preventive health services. And, you know, parenthetically, it should be said that even those minimal preventive health benefits are probably not what we ought to be doing in terms of preventive health. And we clearly have higher sickness and death rates for uninsured individuals as opposed to insured individuals who have chronic or established medical conditions like cancers, diabetes, high blood pressure, etc. And that's also the case for children, by the way. For example, children with asthma or things like that. We also have an economic crisis in this country. Our total healthcare spending has doubled in the last 7 years or so, and is continuing to double. The chunk of our gross national product that we spend in health has gone up since 85, almost 3%. We spend, at least by one generally accepted measure as being the best, about 40% more in healthcare than the next highest spending country in the world, that is Canada. And and healthcare costs and benefits are an issue in discussions between industry and its employees, and also may be one issue involved in our manufacturing productivity problems. I showed you the slide of the Chrysler car manufacturing costs as compared to Canada and Japan and another country. There's one other facet of the problem that I didn't talk about yesterday, and I just want to mention this, and that is that in this country we spend perhaps about $800 per capita per year, per person per year, on healthcare, looked at in a sort of global or a total way. And that's in stark comparison to what the developing world spends. Most developing countries have per person healthcare budget somewhere between, say, $3 and $20 if it's a relatively well-off developing country. That $20 just about pays for the antibiotic that my daughter consumed during a week of treatment for an ear infection a month or two ago. And so we not only have a moral, a justice distribution problem in this country, but I think looked at on a more worldwide scale, we have a massive distribution problem. And truthfully, I'm not sure that I have any great answers as to what to do about that, but it does seem clear to me that unless we get the moral crisis in our own healthcare system taken care of, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to even approach a solution for our interaction with the rest of the world. And that's partly the case because a lot of, there are many aspects of our healthcare system, and to some degree, some of the worst aspects, or at least some of the less approvable aspects that we actually export to third world countries. I guess one other answer to that solution is that that we perhaps need to be a bit more generous in the short term. How many think that we're the most generous country in terms of development assistance in the world? And you're all a sophisticated audience and know that actually on the scale of developed nations, that we contribute a smaller percentage of our gross national product to development for developing countries than almost than any other developed country. And in addition, of course, we're in major arrears in terms of our commitments to multinational development agencies, like, for example, United Nations agencies. We don't even keep up with our pledges. So as a country, we need to do that. And then as individuals, we need to support organizations that are working on healthcare development as well as other types of development that contribute to that broader picture of health that we talked about yesterday, physical, social, mental, in developing countries. Organizations like American Friends Service Committee and Oxfam and Lutheran World Federation, as well as advocacy organizations like Bread for the World, etc. I mean, I'm sure you all have your own favorites. What I promised today was more of a discussion than a diatribe, which was what we had yesterday. And what I'd like to do is to enlist your help in designing a better or perhaps an ideal healthcare system for this country. This ideal system that we come up with may include many aspects of our current system, or perhaps include aspects of our current system that instead we decide we don't like and then want to come up with a different approach to. So I think we can use our current system as one way of thinking about what an ideal system would be. And in some respects, this is what policymakers and politicians and other advocates of healthcare reform do. They essentially take a look at our system, decide what they like, what they don't like, and come up with proposals on the basis of that. They have one advantage that perhaps we don't have quite as much here today, and that is that they have extensive comparisons with other countries available to them and perhaps more sophisticated research about what the broader aspects of our healthcare system entail. But I think we could still have a lot of information among us that we can do this. And it's essentially how it's done. The 30 bills in Congress, basically this is how they're put together. And I'd like to do this. We're going to essentially come up with a list of what we think an ideal healthcare system would look like on the board. And I'd like to do this from a somewhat unique moral perspective. In 1971, John Rawls, who's a prominent American ethicist, wrote a book called The Theory of Justice. And Rawls essentially asked, what was the meaning of justice, or how do we set up a social order that is just? And his answer was that we should have an impartial system of distributive justice. And this may not be exactly what justice means in the New Testament or what Jesus's perspective on justice, but I think it's close enough for government work. So what I hope we can work with today. And the basics, if I can sort of simplify Rawls' argument, Rawls suggests that the way we should design a society, or at least imagine how society ought to be, or in our case today, the way we should perhaps design a healthcare system, is to suppose that we're about to enter that society. But we are each of us are not yet a personified individual. Instead, we're sort of a spirit about to become a member of our society. So, and at that point, we're given task by the great designer, by God, let's say, to design a healthcare system. So we don't really know before we enter that society that we're about to design, or that healthcare system that we're about to design, whether we are rich or poor, whether we are young or old, whether we are a child or an adult, whether we're male or female, whether we're white or a member of an ethnic minority, or whether we're Christian or not, whether we're going to be a doctor or a healthcare worker or a patient, whether we're going to be employed or not. And so, looked at from that perspective, where we become, as designers of a healthcare system, impartial individuals, not necessarily set in our own current perspective, you know, not knowing that I'm a doctor, but knowing that I'm simply going to be in this participant in this healthcare system, but I don't know whether I'm going to be a doctor or a patient. I don't know whether I'm going to be elderly or young. What I'm hoping is that we can throw out some characteristics of what this healthcare system would look like. Anybody want to take a crack at it for starters? Shall I give you an? Go ahead.
Before we get started, yesterday you indicated that the Canadian healthcare system was one of the most efficient ones, and most of them are quite satisfactory. Would there be anything wrong to just use that as a pattern?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's certain aspects of it that are appropriate to use as a pattern. And let's take a crack at it and see if we come up to something that looks like that. What aspect of that system that I talked about yesterday looked attractive to you?
Well, you had a chart here, and it showed all of the various systems in the whole world, and that one seemed was the most efficient one for the cost-wise and the...
One feature of this ideal system would be
universal, no exceptions.
Okay. Nope. Sorry. Well, I guess we'll get rid of that. Okay. Universal in terms of who can participate.
Application. All okay. Patients. All citizens are covered.
Okay.
Of all age groups, no exceptions.
Okay. All citizens or all people. Will. Okay. And you said efficient in terms of how it spends its dollars.
Okay.
And what else? I'm sorry?
Well, what is the efficient coverage between the poor and the more affluent?
Okay. So equal access between the poor and the rich, is that what you're saying? Okay. So equal add in here.
I would say physicians and healthcare workers not putting in the, you know, incredible amount of time that it takes to perform their job, so that
okay.
The family physician doesn't work 90 hours a week.
Okay.
You know, they have more time.
Okay.
So they're not as burnt out.
Okay. That's you're thinking of this in a Rawlsian perspective. That's good. We got to put John Rawls' name up here. That's a good stretch in being impartial. Okay, so providers, let's say, not burned out or not overworked.
Yeah.
Okay. Which actually, even looked at from the patient's perspective, is maybe a good idea, because if you have a burned out, overworked doctor, they're probably going to be less interested in giving you optimal care. So, go ahead, Roman.
I think that there should be a radical change in the philosophy or the attitude about health care.
Okay.
I think that the entire world, if we're talking about, let's say this country.
Well, we're talking mostly about this country, but feel free to throw in the world. That's fine with me.
I think that health care should be looked at from this point of view, that it is the responsibility of each individual to maintain one's health, rather than to feel that it is necessary, that somebody else has to take care of it. So that when children are young, and in our whole education program, say you have a responsibility to keep yourself healthy.
Okay.
All health care is free, but you have a responsibility to keep yourself healthy, because when you are weakened or ill, whatever, you are an impaired member of the human culture. So that instead of thinking about health care as something that, well, I need help, we should think that I have the responsibility to keep myself healthy, and sometimes I might need a brain surgeon, but sometimes I might simply have to change my diet or whatever. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes great sense. Anybody disagree with that or have anything to add?
No, but when I was in grade school, all the shots or whatever required, you automatically this is years back. Everybody had the shots, not a day. I understand when they go to school, then they have to have a list. I'm not sure if this is true.
Uh-huh.
So that again would be responsibility of health.
Okay.
It?
So are you saying that we should perhaps require everybody to have certain preventive health types of things?
Certainly okay. Preventative.
Okay. I took the liberty, by the way, you said care would be free, Roman. I took the liberty putting that on. Is that okay if I put that on here?
I did say that, yes.
Okay. Okay, so some preventive services or some preventive measures like shots.
Well, if you start with the...
would be required.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. All right, at least of kids, okay. You think of adults too? You think adults should be required to do certain preventive things?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
because
see,
that's what okay. keeps your cost down.
Okay, yeah.
Wellness
that's a good
pays.
Point. Wellness pays off because people get sick and therefore you're not spending more money and
yeah.
more sick. And perhaps, you know, there's some moral arguments to be made for wellness too, huh? Okay. Yes, sir.
I'm not sure how you would structure it, but somehow taking the whole service, medical service, out of the free market, market a approach which tends to lead people into specialties rather than general practice, and making us top heavy with the specialists, and inadequately covered with the family and general practice.
Okay, so directed toward primary care.
Yeah.
Again, my apologies for the fact that I'm not very good at writing on the boards. I think we're going to be in the second half there. So okay. I'm sorry, say that again.
Non-profit thinking.
Okay, so non-profit.
And I think it should start with prenatal.
Okay. What other benefits? That's a good one. What other benefits do you think ought to be included besides prenatal, for example, or as long as you brought up, in a sense, that's sort of a benefit or a particular a particular type of care that we want to provide. I mean, anybody have any of the rest of those? You were going to say something. I'm sorry.
Postpartum care. Care for the mother.
Postpartum. Okay. Anything else?
It should include all types of care. We don't need to necessarily say these are supposed to be covered. We're going to cover everybody.
Okay.
For everything they might need.
Okay, so let me go ahead.
I don't know if that is possible, given the level of technology that we have, and if you have limited amounts of healthcare dollars, and do you give everybody bone marrow transplants if they need them, or everybody heart bypass. These are hard choices, hard decisions. There's a lot of things that we are capable of doing.
Let me put these. Yeah, let me put these two things together. You say that we need all types of care, but you say that maybe we don't have the resources for that. So if I can kind of extrapolate what you're saying, since we're talking about an ideal system.
In the ideal system, we'd do it all.
Right, okay, so my escape for the moment anyway, an ideal system. But maybe what we do want is some sort of cost containment. Is that right? Do we want to sort of have some way of holding costs? Is that partly implicit in what you're talking about?
Go ahead, put it down.
Rationing here is a question mark. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
I would prefer to replace the word rationing with priority or prioritizing
medical care, which is
a much more humane way of saying it, as well as a more practical way of administering it.
Okay.
And the source of how you decide what is prioritizable has to do with committee work, general consensus amongst boards of medical examiners, and all that kind of thing, which are really extrapolations of what we are now doing in the American system, but it does not apply universally. It's only applied partly, say, to Medicare subject patients or something like that.
Right, okay. So some system
of where the priority would be exercised.
You just named some. You can start with prenatal care, for instance. You can start with postnatal care, and the hospital board that runs the postnatal clinic, the premature segment, would have to say, have to get together and decide the standards on which low birth weight infants would either receive treatment, heroic treatment, in which case they have a chance of surviving, or would receive very little treatment, in which case they probably wouldn't survive. And we know that as a practical matter, that birth weight has become less and less as the technology has increased, but correspondingly, the child, although it survives, will have more and more life-threatening or life quality
more and more disabilities.
Life quality inhibiting survival, which makes them a perpetual tragedy in the life of the family, being raised as a successful cerebral spastic, for instance, who will never be able to function life as we know it or think of it, and who will be a perpetual drain not only upon their family and all the emotional trauma thereof, but will be a perpetual drain on society in general. We have to decide the cold hard facts when that child is born prematurely or born with a known defect. Do we spend all our resources trying to help this infant with a low survival probability, or do we say, no, we cannot afford to do that, we will let nature take its course, the child will probably die, and we'll take care of it. An infant that will survive and will have a reasonable chance of becoming a useful member.
So
those are committee decisions which we have to do. And I can think of that as one good example.
Yeah, that is a good example. Quality of life considerations, is that a good way to summarize it? Okay, so prioritization by efficacy of the intervention and by quality of life.
Yeah.
Okay.
And those are committee decisions where the responsibility is shared by a number of expert people, with all the pros and cons that committee decisions have.
Okay.
That's part of the cost-efficient equation that you have up there.
Okay, so you're also, if I hear you correctly, you're suggesting that decisions of priority should be by committees of experts.
Yeah.
Anybody have anything else to add to that?
Is there any room for choice to refuse?
Okay, that's good.
I think the gentleman's discussion for an example is a pertinent one, but I would suggest that we not get into the fine details of this, else we will never.
No, I agree.
We'll never get to the.
I agree, but go ahead.
This point he brought up, I think more realistic to apply to the age too. That not having unnecessary treatment is if the life's going to be miserable anyways, or are they going to die anyways?
Okay.
Not all this extreme expense for the extreme age person that isn't going to recover.
Okay. Let me ask you a question, though. Do you think, in general, long-term care should be covered? Should long-term, let's say, nursing home care be covered?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody agree with that?
Look at our age group.
All right. Sorry, had you step out of the Rawlsian perspective. Do you think that if you were a partial observer and you didn't know whether you were going to be young or old, that long-term care should still be covered? Okay. Personally, I think so too. But
we've gotten all of a sudden into the cost factor here. And before we go any farther, I would like to suggest that it's been demonstrated by all other forms of universal health care that the global fee as distributed through a single payment source is the most efficient way of paying for medical care, not the way we do it now in America, where we charge for every Band-Aid, whether it be to a doctor's office or a hospital.
Okay, so you think we should have a single reimbursement source, a single payer, is that right?
I that's the next level when you talk about cost efficiency.
Okay.
Is the global fee combined with the single payment source.
Okay.
So I think we should put that in now because I see that we're already in that.
Okay. All right. How about
what is that global? What does that mean?
Yeah. Global can be redefined as a capitation fee, that is, each doctor or hospital take care of each patient for so many dollars budgeted per number of patients on their list, such as the Kaiser Foundation or Group Health in Washington State, which does that right now and has done it successfully for 50 years.
Okay.
Or as is done in Great Britain and in Canada. That is what is called a global fee. It's another word for capitation.
But I'm wondering, if you put too many rules and regulations, I haven't had a problem with a medical doctor who gives very freely of his time and stuff, and the way the insurance is now set up, you go to these number doctors, you know. Well, then they change in insurance company. So then here you're starting all over again. See, I think you have to be real careful so that the regulations don't become too much, so that you lose good doctors.
Okay, so let me pull at least two or maybe three things out of that and give them back to you as questions. Are you suggesting that doctors and other providers should be able to essentially practice as they see fit, as without anybody looking over their shoulder, or
no,
should there
I'm
be people
that
looking?
At all.
Okay.
I'm not saying whether the doctor should get rich or what. That's
okay.
Not the purpose.
Should they be able to make medical decisions with their patients and for their patients as they see fit? Do you think?
Well, why not? Isn't that what they're doing today?
Well,
there aren't all.
I'm not sure if they're all doing that today. Personally,
well, you have the good with the bad, wherever you're at.
Yeah. Personally, I think, you know, what is sometimes characterized as part of American medicine today is that many physicians feel like they're being micromanaged or micro-scrutinized. Yeah. That is to say, you know, how many people they admit to the hospital, how many people they refer to a consultant, etc., are being scrutinized very carefully on a monthly or a yearly basis.
And see, on the other line, I have a son that's working for a hospital corporation.
Okay.
And this is interesting because he's been up there quite a while.
Uh-huh.
And for instance, you break your leg, your cost should be this much, not all this added in. And as he travels from hospital, sure, your hospital is going to make a profit, but he has to be careful too, so you don't put all these underlying costs in there. So maybe there are some regulations that need to be.
Okay, I kind of I kind of extrapolated from what we said, that doctors should not be closely overlooked, but you're also saying, on the other hand, that they should not be completely free to do absolutely anything. All right, so.
But not so regulated that people who want to become doctors in the future,
okay,
their hands are tied.
Okay, the other aspect that you raised was that when an individual changes insurance these days, oftentimes they're forced to change physicians.
That's right, they have to.
So is there an alternative to that you prefer? Anybody want to?
Well, if you take all these tests for one doctor and all of a sudden,
okay,
whoever you work for.
Let me put it this way. In an ideal system, would clients or patients have access to whatever physician they wanted at whatever point?
Assuming.
So free choice of physician. Okay.
Winston, if that's the case, then you don't prioritize.
That's true. That's true, taken to its utter extreme. But right now, I gotta admit that there are certain aspects of this process that get us to to extremes of ridiculousness. But right now, in any particular town or city, for example, let's say you have a town with three doctors. Each physician is affiliated with one or more insurance plans. If someone changes job or if they change insurance plan, they may get switched from one physician's office to the other physician's office, and the patient has no real control over that in managed care systems. And I think what she was getting at is that, at least within some reasonable bounds, that you ought to have a reasonable access to physicians.
What she's saying, of course, is the Canadian system, where you have universal coverage. If everyone is covered, then your ability to switch from one doctor to the next is implicit, and the only difference are the practical conditions pertaining to certain excrescences and luxuries, which you may have paid for, but the next guy hasn't.
Okay.
But you don't have to worry about which insurance company will cover you if everybody has basic minimum coverage, which is the same everywhere.
Okay. In addition, there's one other feature of the Canadian system, since you raised that I want to point out, that if you move locations, you still have the same benefit. Right now, if you change job, in a sense, you can get your insurance switched because your employer decides to change insurance plans for you, but you may still have roughly the same benefits. You may be asked to go to a different doctor, but you may still have the same benefits. One further aspect of that is that if you change jobs or if you lose your job, you lose your benefits.
Which you cannot do in a universal system.
And in Canadian system, or if you change jobs and you go to another part of the country, you may have completely different benefits. So in a sense, benefits in your ideal system, which in this case you're proposing as Canada being the model, are carried everywhere. People, benefits are... benefits go with you.
And are not based upon employment, they're societal debt. They are not paid through the employer, but through a universal payee that might be through an employer, but are not obligatorily through the employer.
Okay.
Not only not based on employment, but not contingent on whether or not you've had a serious illness.
Exactly.
Because in this country, if you've had a serious illness, you might be able to stay with this same insurance company, but if you have to split, then you may end up without any coverage at all.
That's called no exclusions, and is part of the all citizens coverage.
Yeah.
I'm not sticking up for what I said.
Coverage for all conditions, all pre-existing
covered, no exclusion.
Pre-existing conditions. Okay.
Are we going to be able to live with the taxes that's going to take care of that?
We now pay more in the United States than we would pay if we had a universal system.
Okay. So what you're saying is, you want a system that is not going to cost anything more. Is that right? It's not going to cost any more?
It's okay. Going to cost.
So cost neutral, or at least compared to what we have now. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well,
in your
the
ideal
only thing
system?
Is that if this would go through, there are a lot of good things about it. But somebody's going to pay for it, and we pay for it.
Okay. So, but if somebody gave you this system and you did not have to pay anything more than you're paying right now, would you be happy with that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I would have to take a long look at it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's leave cost neutral on there as an
if
ideal.
If you have this system, then we are doing away with individual insurance companies. Is that right? They all have different kinds of ideas.
I think that that's inherent in what he said back there of a single payment source. So it says
this insurance and that insurance.
Yeah, in essence, I think what we have then is one insurance company that is global, you know, that is the whole shebang.
There is a flip side to that, though, and the one insurance single payment source is, say, such as Social Security, for the basic minimum quality coverage for all citizens, no exceptions, no exclusions. Then if you want extra hand-holding, red carpet treatment, so on, that's where the secondary private insurance companies function.
Okay. So you're suggesting that there should be some secondary avenues of care for people who want extras, things like steak in every hospital meal and plastic surgery for your tummy tucks and your facelifts.
Okay. More rapid treatment if you feel that you can afford it, though the doctor doesn't think it's obligatory.
Okay, secondary access. For, can I use the word frills? Is that fair?
Okay. I would say red carpet treatment and handholding.
Okay. For Cadillacs, okay. I need something
luxury.
Red carpet, okay.
That was a malpractice.
Okay, how does it fit in? How does it fit in? I mean, what do you think? Should we allow malpractice suits?
Well, I think limit because I think maybe that some are misusing this stuff.
Okay. Okay, so then what about people, what should we do about the problem of real, actual malpractice? I mean, I assume you don't think that doctors are perfect. I'm a doctor, and I don't think so. So,
I somehow take it out of the courts into a non-litigation system.
Okay.
Lawyers.
How about a preventive approach to malpractice? Is there anything we can do about it before it happens?
Better oversight of physicians.
Okay.
With some teeth in regulatory agencies.
So some quality oversight maybe, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Or some quality control, to use the 90s buzzword. Go ahead, Prince.
There are also the doctors are prompted to make unnecessary tests just to protect themselves against these suits. So they give you a whole batch of tests which they, in their own mind, really don't feel are necessary, but they have to do it for fear someday somebody's going to say, why didn't you do this?
Okay.
Well, I think the doctors would have, in this kind of system, would have to have some protection for that malpractice so that it doesn't come out of their kind of pocket because we're not going to be in the game.
Okay. All right, so, and protection for physicians. Okay, how about salaries? Do you want to put any control on the salaries of physicians, nurses, hospital administrators, people like that? I mean, anybody have an opinion on that, or is that just open for?
If you have a single payment source, why not for healthcare providers too?
Okay. All right, so for single payment source, both for institutions like clinics and hospitals, and also for healthcare workers. All right. One thing that I throw into this ideal system, which I think is probably something that a number of my colleagues don't necessarily agree with, but one of the difficulties with the healthcare system as I see it is that there's a wide disparity between what physicians make and what associate healthcare workers, like, for example, nurses, or even more so, nurses' aides make. And I think one of the shames of the system is that many nurses' aides, for example, not only have, you know, wages that probably are not a whole heck of a lot better than they could make at McDonald's, but they also don't have any more healthcare benefits than they could get at McDonald's either. So and I think that this sort of that degree, that wide a degree of inequity is maybe a problem as well. So let's see.
Could this system include any way of educating these specialists and doctors so they wouldn't be coming out of their college days with thousands and thousands of dollars worth of debt that they have to pay?
Sure. Okay, that's interesting. So basically what you're proposing is some unified system of educational financing for healthcare professionals, so that healthcare professionals aren't paying for their own education.
Okay. Well, we have systems like that right now. That's not a new idea. The military, many states, the public health service, a great many scholarships exist for people who would like to take physician's training in return to for a specified number of years of care, say working in a public health clinic or in a staffing a core city center underprivileged ghetto type of clinic. There are all kinds of good things which can be paid for by scholarships.
Okay, so I put one thing I got out of that as well is that not only that we already have established mechanisms of public and voluntary financing of education, and that maybe what you're suggesting is that needs to be universal, but also that that we maybe need to look at the distribution of providers, of physicians and other healthcare workers, so that we get a more equal distribution of those in our country. Go ahead,
Barbara. Well, I think that's what I was going to say, is that rural, if it was kind of like the system where, you know, ministers get paid no matter what the size of their congregation, you know, a similar amount in some form, in some religions, then physicians who live in these little tiny towns of 300, or these towns of 300 could have a physician. The rural, you know, not all concentrated in the cities.
Yeah. Okay. So great. Well, you guys are good at this. Because I've only got an hour, because I promised those of you who are leaving on the bus this afternoon that we're going to try to do some of tomorrow's today. So I'm sorry, you have one more thing to say.
But yeah. I have been wondering, listening, if there's any stricter rules or laws that could be made in regard to suing a doctor. So they are sued for such. Like one time I read in the paper that a lady had sued the doctor because she took three cough drops in a row. Well, the doctor didn't tell her she could sit there and eat them all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And then they made her sick another way. So is there a better law they can make so we don't have all these?
Yeah, I think, you know, right now that's maybe one of the areas of healthcare system reform that we've gotten the farthest on, although we're certainly not there yet. But there have been a number of states that have experimented with various approaches to that. And there continue to be noises made from Congress and from the administration that they think that's a priority as well. So, yeah, I agree. Okay, well, what I want to do, I think I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to do this, but I want you to pair up in twos or threes and decide which of this entire list, which two things of this entire list you think are the top priority for a ideal healthcare system. And then we're gonna do a quick tallying up the votes, okay? If you find that it's too difficult to do by twos or threes, we'll do it by ones. So anyway, the emphasis is gonna be in trying to do this quickly since we've kind of gone up to the wire here. So decide which two you think are the top priority. Okay, all right. Okay, well, we're going to do this. I apologize that this is going to be sort of a majoritarian approach to things. This isn't particularly fair as a way of designing an ideal system, but I realize there are a lot of things to be said, you know, in the prioritization of each of these and the fact that a lot of these things simply cannot be prioritized.
It's not common
but,
sense.
That's right. This is how Congress says it, right? The good point. We'll get to that in a minute. But nevertheless, I do want to get some sense of what people think is most important. So what I'm going to do is just roll down the list here, and I want you to raise hands if you're the voter of your group, whether that was one of the two things that you said. Okay, how about equal access for all citizens? Okay, so I've got about five there. How about cost efficiency or cost effectiveness? Okay, I've got about five or so there. How about providers not, doctors and other providers not overworked? Okay, how about each individual responsible for their own health? Okay, one there. We'll come back to that in a minute, Roman. How about free care? Okay. Okay, you don't know what that means. Okay, how about preventive measures like shots and some for adults would be mandatory? Okay, nobody with hands up for that. How about directed toward primary care specialties or focusing on primary care access? Okay, how about nonprofit? All right. We're not getting hands for any of these. How about postpartum care, and we're going to include prenatal care in that. Anybody have hands up for that? Okay. How about all types of care provided or included? One, two, did I see three, four, six, okay, or so? I'm going to start to circle those that are kind of giving the numbers here. Okay. How about cost containment? Okay, here's one. How about prioritization of the efficacy of care and based on the, or prioritization based on efficacy and quality of life? Okay, there's one. I think that in the system that I've devised, one or two is still a fairly strong vote. How about decisions of priority by committees of experts? Okay. How about choice to reduce treatment? You refuse treatment, longer term care coverage, a single payment source both for
treatment?
Yeah, okay, that was one there, okay. Single payment source for institutions and for providers, okay. Got lots of people that are voting more than twice here, but I guess we'll go with that. Tried to rig my. Do you want to say something, or are you voting back there?
I'm voting.
Okay, all right. You think a lot of these things should be included, no, I get the feeling.
The problem is that nearly everyone feels that all of these factors are important.
Okay, I agree with that. I agree with that.
The voting mechanism here is a little distorted.
Okay, I agree with that. I apologize for this distorted voting mechanism. Let's see, how about free choice of physician? How many groups felt strongly about that one? Okay. All right, we're going to give that a couple. How about benefits go with you no matter where you move or what job you're in? Okay, there was actually a couple groups voting there that did vote at some of the others. Coverage of all pre-existing conditions. Okay, cost neutral, that is to say we're not spending any more money on healthcare than we are right now. Secondary access for red carpet care like tummy tucks and stakes in the hospital. How about quality control? Anybody have that on their top two list? Okay, back there, everything's pretty much on your list. Okay, how about public financing of health education? Anybody think that was a maximum priority? Okay, all right. We need to talk after. You and I see this whole thing very similarly. Okay, well, as Mike suggested, this is what Congress does. And just to give you some sense of what options are out on the table, and then what they categorize are. This is a list similar to what we came up with. John Conyers, who's the head of the Government Operations Committee in the House of Representatives, a major player on the health care system reform debate, came up with this list. Nobody constrained him to only two choices, so he had, he could do whatever he wanted. He said a healthcare system should be universal, should be comprehensive in terms of who it covers, and universal comprehensive in terms of what it covers, that is to say, all things like long-term care and dental benefits, mental health care, drug abuse, all types of prenatal care, etc., should be universal, that is to say, it covers everybody in the country. should not involve co-pays or deductibles, should give individuals basically a free choice of what doctor they want to go to, should be government financed, it should be cost controlled, that is to say there's no new spending total in the country on healthcare than what we're spending now, and it should be progressively financed, that is to say that how we pay for it or how each individual contributes to how we pay for it is based to some degree on your ability to pay, which suggests to me progressive financing mechanisms. The most progressive that we have that's currently established is the federal income tax, but there are probably other approaches to that. That it should be equitable, that benefits should be transferable no matter what job you go to, if you move from job to job or from state to state. That there should be a focus on quality assurance and on preventive health, as I said, long-term care should be coverage, and that in addition he includes outreach to medically neglected individuals. There's some parts of our population that are neglected or don't have access for more than simply financial reasons. For example, one of the problems with migrant farm workers, one of their barriers to access is language, Hispanics speaking Spanish and not being able to access the system for that reason. In addition, I just wanted to get back to Roman's statement about responsibility for your own health care, which I think is an important feature of it and sometimes gets lost in the national debate on this, something that I think is important to keep in mind. We really need that in our system. There are basically four different, or three different, depending how you count them, but I divide it as four different approaches that have been proposed to health care reform. And they break down into what's generally called the conservative or a free market approach. A couple of the groups that have been advocating this are the Heritage Foundation, Professor Regina Herzliger of Harvard University, who's a healthcare economist. There's a bill by Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Senate File 454, that sort of puts this approach into action. And basically, the approach is that you take everybody's healthcare benefits now and you give them directly to the individual. So rather than having your employer choose a healthcare plan for you, you get that amount of money that your employer spends on healthcare. It gets given to individuals or to families as a voucher, and then they are free to go out and choose the healthcare plan that they think is best in the competitive marketplace. And for individuals who don't have an employer, the proposal is usually that we expand one of the government programs to cover all those individuals. Some elements of that are included in President Bush's, quote, proposal, if you can call it that, and in some of the things that the American Medical Association says. Essentially, what I categorize this as, somewhat pejoratively, I admit, is as tax tinkering. And basically what Bush is proposing is that every individual who's below a certain income level, below I think it's 150% of the poverty line, be given a tax credit, be given essentially a rebate, so that they can go out and use that rebate to purchase their own health care. And Bush also proposes some increase in public plans, including Medicaid, to cover uninsured individuals. He proposes to finance this by some modest tax increases in a few, you know, sort of corners of the tax spectrum. Increases tax on medical benefits of wealthy individuals is one of the ways that he proposes to pay for the public aspect of this. One sort of whole grab bag of proposals that is perhaps the one that's in the lead in the marketplace of ideas right now are generally called payer play or employer mandate proposals. Lots of different versions of this in Congress that are similar in their basics. George Mitchell and Kennedy and several other senators have put it in a bill. Mitchell's bill is Senate 1227. It's essentially the basis of presidential candidate Bill Clinton's proposal. It's the basis of a committee headed by John Rockefeller. Senator Rockefeller called the Pepper Commission, named after its previous chairman, Claude Pepper. And they presented their proposal in, I think it was June or so of last year. And also it's, in some respects, the essence of the recently passed comprehensive care plan in the state of Minnesota that was passed about 3 months ago or so, called HealthRight. And the final option, the fourth option, is a single payer system. In most respects, modeled to a large degree after Canada, it is to some extent the basis of Oregon's controversial healthcare system, their Medicaid-Medicare proposal. The difference between the Oregon system and a more universal single care system is the Oregon system really only applies to government finance programs right now, so it doesn't really have anything to do with individuals who have private insurance or HMO insurance. It's also a part of a bill in Congress promoted by John Conyers, I think it was House Resolution 5,500 of the previous session. I'm not sure what its number is now. And it's the essence of a new Senate bill, really the first one of this sort that's been proposed in any comprehensive way in the Senate, presented by Paul Wellstone, Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota, along with Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio, and Paul Simon of Illinois is his other co-sponsor on that. And to summarize these in short order, the conservative free market approach and the Bush approach would probably not ensure universal access, although Heritage Foundation suggests that that everybody be required to have insurance. Essentially, it would be like auto insurance. You'd be able to drive a car, you have to have auto insurance. To be able to live in this country, you have to have health insurance. So in essence, and they suggest that you have to prove that you have that at the same time that you file your income tax form. So in a sense, that would ensure access, but it would do it in a way that I'm not sure that most people consider too palatable. Bush's system expands the system, but for reasons that basically because it requires a poverty cutoff eligibility system, it's not going to take care of a number of individuals. There's still going to be a chunk of the uninsured that are going to continue to be uninsured. So basically that doesn't provide universal access. Payer-paid plans usually mandate that why it's called payer-play is that employers either have to play, that is to say they have to provide health insurance for their employees, or else they have to pay a tax, and then there's going to be a government pool that's going to cover all those individuals whose employer doesn't pay for their health insurance or who are unemployed.